Hello, everyone, in Waterloo and Ontario, and hopefully in the world. We're very glad to welcome you to yet another lecture as part of this Quantum to Cosmos Festival. My name is Neil Turok, and I'm the lucky guy who's the director of the Perimeter Institute. I want to thank everyone for joining us. There's a lot more exciting to come this week. This event is part of the lecture series presented by KPMG, and so let me begin by thanking KPMG for the support of all these lectures happening over these 10 days. Before we begin the lecture, can I ask you to please, those of you who have cell phones, to turn them off. Thank you, Jen. And those of you at home, please do email a friend or someone you know and tell them this lecture is happening live. I know I watched David Corey's lecture live online yesterday at home, and the quality is unbelievable. So please let people know this is happening right now. You can also follow what's happening on Twitter at Q2C Festival. So now it's my great privilege and pleasure to introduce the speaker for this lecture, who is Dr. S. James Gates, Jr., or better known to most of us as Jim. And Jim is the Toll Physics Professor and Director of the Center for String and Particle Theory at the University of Maryland. Jim is known for many things in theoretical physics. Among them, he was the author of the classic textbook on supersymmetry. The title was Superspace, 1001 Lessons in Supersymmetry. And I know this came out when I was a graduate student, and it's a very impressive tome. Since then, the ideas propounded in that book have been extremely influential, and it's one of the main tasks of the Large Hadron Collider at CERN to test this proposed theory of supersymmetry. On top of that, Jim, I have to say, is a super guy. And not only someone of substance, but also incredible style, as you will find out. I know this personally because when I was involved with opening a center for math in Cape Town, South Africa, Jim was one of our opening guests and speakers. And not only did he come and deliver a great lecture, but just as a gift to the center, he arrived with a wonderful promotional video of the signifying the importance of this center for Africa, and of course we've been using it ever since. So Jim is an extraordinary person. We were delighted to learn of his appointment to President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. I think President Obama will be getting great advice, and please welcome me today. Join me in welcoming Jim as he gives his account of why there may be a genetic basis for reality.
Good day. First of all, I would be remiss unless I thank the organizers of this meeting. It's a wonderful meeting. It's my first visit to Perimeter. I've been meaning to get here for a while, and so they finally were able to get me here. I'm not really going to have a chance to properly visit, but hopefully this will be the first of many visits when I can get back to the Institute. The Institute is quite an unusual organization, world-renowned. Though the organization is very young, believe me, we in the physics community know very well PI. And so there's a jewel of physics right here in Waterloo, Canada, and all of those who support the PI let me express the gratitude of my community, not just me, because these sorts of treasures make sure that physics continues to move into the future with astounding results, unexpected. So I'm going to talk about, does reality have a genetic basis? Well, first of all, we have to understand genetic here in quotes, because obviously There aren't going to be cells out there giving rise to, reality, but something rather similar to a code is really going to be our ultimate goal. So I want to talk to you about this strange code that research that I've been working on. So let's begin by taking a journey. We'll go down in size. We're going to do this by powers of 10. Each mark on this image represents a power of 10, 10 times smaller than the previous one. So we're going to speed up the beginning, going very fast past a lot of interesting chemistry, biology, condensed matter, and slow down at blood cells at around 10 to the minus 5. These are newly representations of newly emerging blood cells. They still have their nuclei intact as they leave the bone marrow. At 10 to the minus 9, we encounter strands of DNA. That's what the Human Genome Project was all about, learning how to read the code. And in fact, there's a code buried here, and this code we can think of as the Book of Life. This is what the code sort of looks like. If you actually were able to read off strands of DNA, you find out it's sequences of letters A, T, G, and C. These actually stand for adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, which are the base pairs that appear in the double helix as discovered by the Watson and Crick some years ago. The DNA, of course, is really interesting because it also, in addition to being a book of life, it's a book also of human history. DNA has revealed a wonderful story about how we are all intimately related to each other. Coming out of Africa a couple of hundred thousand years ago and watching waves of humanity go out and populate the world. And so I like to say philosophers have been for millennia saying that all of us are brothers and sisters, but now we scientists can say it with much more force and vigor and with much more explicit knowledge than has ever been humanly possible before. That's the power of science to tell us who we are. So DNA doesn't stop the story. We can go to smaller scales. At 10 to the minus 10, we enter the world of the atom. This is a representation of the clouds of electrons around a typical atom. And of course, the atom itself is an interesting story. Part of it we see in this symbol. I think of this as the Mona Lisa of science. Almost everybody in the world has seen this at some point in their life. And it's a little bit mysterious, like that smile on the Mona Lisa. And yet, it's so familiar to us. And so chemistry, this table given to us by Mendeleev, was in some sense a major breakthrough for our species in understanding the place in which we live. There's a joke about Mendeleev and the Tsar. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I'll share it with you. Supposedly, the Tsar at some point gave Mendeleev a medal. And so I heard this story from Sergey Brin's father, who's a mathematician at the University of Maryland. And he said, "So Jim, you know the Tsar gave Mendeleev a medal." I'm like, "No, I didn't know that." He said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Oh, the Tsar was so forward-looking." He said, "Oh, no, 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 no. The medal was for the improvement in the distillation of vodka." We can continue to go down in size past the world of the atom. And about the time I was graduating from high school, and this is a helium atom, we see two blue balls for protons, two pink ones for neutrons. And inside of these smaller balls, we see smaller pieces of matter. They're called quarks. They were discovered about the time I graduated from high school in 1969 through a series of experiments that were performed at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center. They were called the deep inelastic scattering experiments. That's when we learned that inside protons, there are these little small objects that act like little balls inside of a bag. And so you think of the proton as a bag, but these things inside are even smaller and more fundamental. At this, I've stopped at 10 to the minus 18 because 10 to the minus 18 is the limit of our technological prowess as a species. We have no devices that can measure anything that is smaller than this length. And so as we journey in this talk to ever smaller scales, because we will, you have to understand that these smaller scales are not accessible to us through the normal means of science, which is experimentation and observation. And so when I talk to the public about this kind of science, I always try to make sure that people understand that after we leave this limit, we're talking about what we think is the case, suppositions, propositions. But they're based not on wild guesses. They're based on a very powerful set of eyes, a set of eyes called mathematics. Most people think of mathematics as this horrible thing that is done to you in school. But some of us actually have come to the point where we realize that mathematics is an extrasensory perception organ. We have our usual five senses. Then we have this one more sense that allows us to look out at the universe and see realms that are not accessible by any other means. And so as we continue our journey down in size, I'm going to be talking to you about mathematics, because that's the only tool that our species has to guide us in these realms that are beyond our technological capabilities. Just above that limit, however, these small objects called quarks were found around 69. And so it turns out that when we first discovered them, we thought there were three of them. We called them up, down, so up, down, and strange quarks. We now know, in fact, this number is 18. And this is sort of one of the modern versions of the table of elements. In many physics departments around the world, you'll find this table. It tells us about the quarks, which we see listed here, up, down, charm, strange, top, and bottom. But in addition, we also list the electron as a fundamental particle. Those clouds of electrons whirling around the atom is a fundamental particle. But the electron belongs to a family of particles that are called leptons. And so the lepton, in addition to the electron, we have the muon and the tau particle. The mu is about 200 times as heavy as the electron, but in all other ways, it's an electron. The tau is about 1,700 times as heavy as an electron, but in all other ways, it is an electron. In addition, there are neutral partners to the electrons, which are called neutrinos. So this side of our table is stuff. It's you. It's the parts list from which your parts are built. But I like to tell people, you're much more beautiful to look at than a sea of leptons and quarks. So why are you so pretty? Well, the answer is because your parts are held in nice patterns by forces. And in nature, there are four forces: the gravitational force, the weak nuclear force, electromagnetic force, and the strong force. Each of these forces actually has a message carrier that carries the effect of the forces back and forth. For the electromagnetic force, the message carrier is the photon. The same particle of light that you're using to see me is the message carrier for charge, electrical charge. The the weak nuclear force has three carriers. We call the carriers the W plus, the W minus, and the Z. It has another carrier, which we'll talk about a little bit later, but we haven't actually seen this last one in the laboratory. And then finally, there's a carrier that keeps the quarks bound to the interior of protons. It actually has eight such carriers. They're called gluons. So quarks are confined. So this is sort of a cartoon. When someone asks you to think of a proton, I hope you'll keep this picture in mind in the future as opposed to a little billiard ball. This is a more accurate depiction. But it's not a static place. In fact, it moves around, it bends, it warps. And so let me grab one of the protons with my mathematical tweezers and try to pull it out the side. And as you see, I don't quite succeed. In fact, a separate bubble is created from the blue quark that I was pulling out. And in fact, that's how nuclear reactions seem to work. If you had the power with a device to try to extract a quark from the interior of a proton, we believe you would never succeed. Instead, a new piece of nuclear matter would envelop the quark that you were trying to extract, just like in our cartoon here. This property is called confinement. And so quarks are confined, apparently, to the interiors of nuclear matter, never to be freely seen. Quarks, well, if you know about quarks, they're sort of a glad bag, because we say now, protons and neutrons are bags, so we can throw stuff in them. But who determines which quarks you throw in them? And a moment ago, I told you there were 18 quarks. So you have 18 different choices of what you can put inside the bag. And when you, depending on your choice, you get a different nuclear particle. Now, this particular table here is a set of particles that are very famous in my community, especially the particle here at the bottom. So let me tell the story about this table. Well, first of all, you look at the table for a second and you say, gee, that's very pretty. And one of the things that's really interesting about theoretical physics is that our sense of aesthetics really is a very valuable tool in guiding us to finding theories that are effectively accurate descriptions of nature. So when you see something pretty, it's not just that it's pretty. More often than not, something that's pretty is often right. And so when you look at this table, you'll see this object at the bottom of the table. It's called the omega minus. Well, you see, this table didn't always look like this. And back in around 1961 and 1962, the only parts of this table were known were the objects that were in the upper three tiers of the table, starting with the xi, the sigmas, and the deltas. That's what was known. And in fact, there was a very famous meeting that took place in Geneva, Switzerland. And the announcement of these of the second tier objects, the xi's, was made. And in the audience, there were two people who had been studying patterns of particles. And they immediately recognized that having experimentally found the two tier, the ones that are at tier two, they said immediately, there must be something at tier one. One of those people was Murray Gell-Mann, and who raised his hand and went to the lectern and announced that at some point in the future, you will find the lowest tier particle. 2 years later, it was found. And that was, in fact, one of the reasons why we physicists really started to believe in quarks, because this pattern is just throwing the quarks into the bag and looking what are the possibilities. In fact, quarks can go on in not just three triplets, they can also go as doublets, as we showed. So there are objects called mesons. These are some of the mesons. And then the proton and neutron, which are the familiar particles of nuclear of atomic physics that you know from your high school science, are actually part of a bigger family of objects, an octet. Well, I've been talking about scales of size. And so we talked about this limit of 10 to the minus 18. You could ask me, well, Professor Gates, what is it that's looking at these tiny scales of 10 to the minus 18? So we're going to make a slight detour in our talk because I want to talk a little bit about where this is going on. It's principally work underway at the Laser Interferometry Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO. It's located, there are lots of LIGO sites. We have two in the United States, one in Johnston Parish in Louisiana, and the other in the Hanford Reservation in the state of Washington. And at these places, what we're going to try to do as a species is measure something we've never measured before. You see, again, if you look at my animation here, I've got two blue balls, those are protons, two clear yellowish balls. Gee, they changed themselves from pink to yellow, but, you know, let's not be concerned with color for a moment. And you'll notice there's a thin red line that's in this diagram. If this was to scale, that thin red line would be 1/1,000th the size of the balls that you see looking there. That's the number that's going to be measured at LIGO. We're going to be looking at 1/1,000th the size of a proton. And that's the limit of our technological prowess. We don't know how to, we can't build a device to measure anything smaller, but we can certainly try to go after this. And why are we doing this? Well, I'll come to that later in the talk. Well, you've probably heard of the Big Bang machine. It's going to create black holes, and they're going to suck up the world, and all of our problems will go away. Well, fortunately, reality is a little bit more pacific than that. We don't have to worry about the black holes eating us up, apparently. The Large Hadron Collider is a machine that is currently beginning its operating stages in Geneva, Switzerland. It's a proton-proton synchrotron. Well, what does that mean? Well, it takes protons, it speeds them up with electrical fields, it uses magnetic fields to bend their paths, and then we collide them at an energy of 7 TeV per beam. If you flew over Geneva at about 30,000 feet, you'd see something like this. Well, actually, you wouldn't see the red circle. But the rest of it is pretty accurate. You see the Alps in the background. You can see Lake Geneva here. And if you had Superman's vision and could look down through the ground, you would, in fact, see a ring, the structure that we've illustrated in red here. So here's a more accurate representation. The ring, the Large Hadron Collider, is a ring-type accelerator which crosses the border from Switzerland to France. It exists in the form of a pre-injection device where we're first starting to speed up the protons. And then we actually speed them up yet some more in a larger device, getting them to move at 0.99999 the speed of light. We are making protons move faster than anything that humans have ever propelled before at this device. This is an overview of the device. For the United States, we've invested as a nation about $700 million in two detectors, one by the name of ATLAS, the other compact muon solenoid detector. If you were, again, with Superman, you could sort of look under the ground and see that all the structures there. Two devices, often depicted like this, these are images that have appeared in some publications. If you could actually go down into the tube, what you'd find is a big pipe. That's not very impressive scientifically. But this big pipe is evacuated for an obvious reason. If you're going to make protons move at 0.999999 the speed of light, you don't want them bumping into anything. And particularly, you don't want them bumping into air molecules. And so we evacuate this pipe, and the electrons are protons are confined to the interior. The detectors, the CMS detector. Again, I like to point out to people there are these cartoon-type drawings, but here's the actual device, and there's a technician with a lab coat on standing in the interior of the device in this image. So you get some sense of the scale of these devices. The Atlas device is rather similar. Again, you can find many depictions like this in publications, but if you actually were going to Geneva during the construction phase, you could actually go inside of Atlas. And here our technician has changed clothes. He's now wearing a set of brown jeans and a jacket, and a dark brown jacket and a hard hat. Maybe you're having a hard time seeing the hard hat. This is a simulation for what you get for all these billions of dollars spent. Looks like chicken scratch. In fact, I've often told people that when my children were young, we can produce things like this for you too. If you'll just give us a small fraction of the same amount of money, we'd be very happy to. So here's some animations that illustrate how the device works. So we speed up protons with the pre-injection devices. We cause them with magnetic fields to move in circular paths. And then after we have them at the maximum speed possible, we let them free into the larger ring. Now, if you were flying above Switzerland at the time this was going on, you wouldn't see very much. So let's go down inside the pipe. We'll go racing along, and since we're kind of heavy, we can't quite go as fast as the protons. So they're going to pass us, so we'll see bunches of them passing us. Now, the numbers are much more dense than represented in this cartoon. We're talking about 10 to the 17 protons, or 16, 15. We're not talking about 3 or 4 protons. We're talking about massive numbers of protons racing past us. And now we'll come outside of one of the detectors, and let's go in just as some of these protons bump into each other. You get these massive explosions. And maybe this is where the black holes will be created, but like I said, the odds are we're safe from these things. At the very end of these explosions, what we're looking for are those signatures. So why are we looking for those signatures? Well, in my table of what we know, we talked about the quarks, we talked about the leptons, we also talked about the force carriers, but we also did not talk about one more force carrier for the weak force called the Higgs boson, which we've never seen. And so one of the primary purposes of the LHC will be to look for the Higgs boson. But that's not all the LHC we'll look for. You see, in the early 70s, I was a graduate student at MIT, and I began reading the literature about a possibility which I found stunning, namely that there were more forms of matter and energy in the universe than we had ever imagined possible. And so if that's the case, to me, you live at an exciting time when such a proposal is made. And so this is the idea of supersymmetry, the kind of work that Neil was kind enough to mention in his introduction. I've been one of the people worried about this topic forever, it seems to me. And so it could be that in nature, there's a kind of mirror property. So here is all the ordinary matter and energy that we know about. And so if this idea is correct, the electron has kind of a copy. But this is a different kind of copy. It spins at a rate that's different from the electron rate of spin. Electrons, it turned out, act like little spinning basketballs. In fact, all of the elementary particles act like little spinning basketballs. And so here, the spin is different, but in other ways, this thing is like an electron. We call it a selectron. We've even given names to these things, even though we've never seen them in laboratory experiments. In our world, there are up and down quarks inside of protons. If this mirror property is correct of supersymmetry, there will be up and down squarks somewhere waiting to be found in nature. In our world, there is the graviton, which is the carrier of the gravitational force, which is the thing that's going to be causing that 10 to the minus 18 measurement that we're after at the LIGO experiment. But if this mirror property is correct, there will also be gravitinos, something else that carries gravity that is slightly different. In our world, the photon exists, it allows you to see me. If this mirror world exists, then there are photinos that are out there to be found. My favorite particle in this list, however, is this one. The W and Z particles we talked about as carriers of the weak nuclear force, where this supersymmetry is correct, they have partners, what are called superpartners. So the W particle has a partner called the Zeno, and the Z particle has a partner called the Zeno. The W particle has a partner also. Its name is spelled W-I-N-O. Now, I like to tell people, if you ever see a headline on a major newspaper where you see W-I-N-O found at Geneva, you should be aware that we're not talking about some inebriated guy who happened to stumble into the laboratory. We're talking about the super partner to this object that people like me have wondered about for over 30 years. Now, why do we believe super partners exist? Because we have never seen them in the laboratory. Well, part of the reason is this is the continuation of our journey. Let's continue down in size, 26, minus 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35. At that scale, for about 30 years, we have a fair amount of mathematical evidence that suggests that our universe perhaps is described by something called the superstring. That's why you see super often attached to this business. It's some kind of a structure. It's a math, for us right now, it's a piece of mathematics. We understand a fair amount of its mathematical properties. And if it's there, everything about our reality is somehow connected to these small filaments. And people often like to say these are filaments of energy, but that's actually wrong. Energy is made of this stuff, not the reverse. In fact, these things would be the ultimate author of our reality, not anything else. So you don't express these things in terms of energy or these things in terms of particles. It's the other way around. Particles and energy are expressed in terms of these things, just like elements, compounds are made from atoms, not atoms are made from compounds. So these would be, we think, perhaps the end of the story. And the idea of string theory naturally leads to superpartners. So that's why we need something like the LHC to tell us, are we on the right track? You see, this is how physics is distinguished from other philosophical beliefs. We can say crazy things, and Neil will get up and say something crazy, I'll get up and say something crazy, but the way that we ultimately are held to our standard is you propose an experiment to say, is your idea crazy enough? Because it turns out really crazy ideas are right. If ideas are not crazy enough, you get rid of them. And it's experiment that makes this determination for us. Physicists produce this kind of stuff, at least theoretical physicists. On the left here, we have Maxwell's equations. I like to call them the beeper cell phone equations, because it turns out that these equations, first written in 1876, are the reason we have these devices. You see, if Maxwell hadn't written these equations, no one could imagine actually how to build such a device. So these are the results of mathematics. I can say these things are loaded with math. For you people who don't like mathematics, take these things off. Don't use them. They're loaded with mathematics. On the other hand, in 1916, Einstein gave us a different set of equations, not talking about electromagnetic forces, but talking about gravity. So Maxwell's equations basically say if you take a charge and shake it, a kind of wave generates out from it, and that's the electromagnetic signal that we pick up with these things. Einstein has told us that gravity actually creates dimples in space-time. So just as the sun has a dimple around it that causes the Earth to orbit it, if you looked at the animation, you saw there was a dimple around the Earth as it moved, and that dimple is responsible for the moon orbiting the Earth. So massive objects deform space and time according to Einstein's equations. So now we're going to talk about this strange topic that I want to give you all that as background to tell you what I've been doing for about the last 10, 15 years. Part of my work started in the middle 90s, and the second part with this image work actually started in the early 2000s. So this is the kind of stuff people like me sit around and do. And we're very proud of ourselves, by the way. Gee, isn't that a cool equation? You know, ask Neil, he'll tell you all about it. And so we write equations. Equations are us. That's one way you should think about theoretical physicists. We write equations. But we write equations in the service of accurately describing nature. That's our whole point. So although those equations are cool, these are cooler. They're colorized, right? What could be more beautiful than adding color to equations? Well, it turns out this is the same set of equations I showed you before. I've expanded them in a certain way to get at the point that I can introduce these color elements to the dull mathematics that you perhaps saw when you were in uni. Well, it turns out that it's not just a matter of colorization, because this figure that I'm showing you here contains most of the information of the equations that I just showed you. Not all the information, but most of the information is in this figure. Let's go back a little bit and talk about how that could be. You see these two things here? These are functions, and that's what you measure. If you measure maybe a length or how hot something is, you measure a function. That's what physicists are all about. So these two particular functions, A and B, in this set of equations, correspond to these two nodes of the diagram here at the bottom. The four functions that you see in the middle here, listed as psi 1, psi 2, psi hat 1, psi hat 2, are the four black nodes that you see in the middle of this diagram. And finally, the two functions f and g that you see in the equations are the two white nodes that you see at the top of the diagram. And so I hope to have convinced you that in some sense, there's some information that's in the equations that is also contained in these pictures. But let me now introduce you to a more sophisticated picture that has some dashings and colors and dashings attached. These dashings stand for minus signs. And you know, if you've ever done some homework in a math class, you know the importance of a sign. You know, your teacher will give you a good grade for a plus sign, but a bad grade for a minus sign in your calculation. So often we worry about signs. This image that I've just showed you at the bottom contains every single piece of mathematical information that these equations contain. In fact, this image is a type of compression for people who do computer science. Compression is you take some statements and you package them in such a way that the information is placed in a much smaller subset. Now, these images, which we call adinkras, and I'll have to tell you a story about how this came about. I was in this country of Georgia, a couple of hundred miles north of Tehran in 2002. And I started getting some email. I saw a paper on the archive. We physicists have been talking to each other by electronic means for about 20 years now. That's our primary mode of communication. I saw a paper on the archive by a physicist by the name of Michael Fox. And I looked at his paper and I said, gee, that's funny. That looks a little bit like something I've been talking about in some of my papers. Because you see, physics, although people often think we physicists go off into a dark room and, you know, conjure some spirits or chant incantations and then come out with our equations, that's not really the way it works. We're in constant conversation with our colleagues. And in fact, it's that conversation that spurs us to think of new ideas and vice versa. So I saw this paper that Michael Fox had written. I said, gee, that's interesting. I think it's related to something I've been doing. I sent him a message. Then he sent me back some messages saying, gee, that's interesting what you're saying. I wasn't aware of your work. And so we had this intense conversation going back and forth for about a month, never having met each other, which shows you something about the power of the internet. We finished a research paper on this topic of graphically taking the information from the conventional way that we write in mathematical equations and putting them into pictures. And we finished this work when I was in the West African country of Benin. So we needed a name for these things. And so Michael, who this entire time was actually in the Slovak Republic, so that shows you how it all works, right? You don't meet these people, they're just there in cyberspace someplace. So it's like a voice that just comes out of nowhere, right? And so Michael came up with this name of Dinkras, and I said, what's that? And he said, well, it comes from West Africa, from the Akan people. So Dinkras are actually a traditional mode of symbolism. Here we see some actual adinkras, as opposed to our mathematical borrowing of the expression. The first one, by the way, is the king of the adinkras, for whatever that means. But you know, traditional people have their own ways of knowing things. And although we in the West often are not as appreciative as we might be of the information there, it's often some very surprising things are there. So we're going to borrow this name, adinkras. And Michael came up with a suggestion. He said, sort of, it's a symbol that has hidden meaning. I said, fine, we'll go for it. Here's some more of what I do. You see, these funny little pictures, if you have never seen them before, and most of my colleagues never have, the first question they ask is, Jim, either you're crazy, what use can these things be? And so one of the things I like to point out to people who raise this question with me, and I'm going to show you four pages of mathematics. You're looking at two of them. Here are the other two. These four pages of mathematics represent a set of equations that no one had ever found in over 20 years of looking. And we were able, and I'll introduce you to our we at the end of our talk, because I'll do an acknowledgement, that my work has been done in the context of collaboration with a number of people I've invited to this project. Michael was one of them in our conversation. They're mathematicians, computer scientists. So, you know, we're just a bubbling little community. But we knew about those equations because we also understood these pictures. In fact, these pictures were guides to us, at least to me personally, and trying to figure out what kinds of equations that were no one had ever seen before were possible and were mathematically consistent. And so this actually is one of the most powerful pieces of proof I can give to people that having this alternative way of looking at the mathematics brings value. Because if you can find something that people have missed for over 20 years using standard methods, then what you're doing must have some value, and especially if you can find equations this complicated, then they can go off and check them for a couple of weeks to see that they're right. Well, so that's part of the story of Adinkras. They're these funny kind of images that encode exactly information from equations, and the equations themselves are related to string theory. They have this property called supersymmetry. So these Adinkras, where do they sort of come from? I mean, you can say, aha, you start with these equations, and yeah, you can do these calculations, you can find more equations no one's ever seen, but is there a simpler way to understand these things? The answer turns out to be yes. Working with other of my collaborators, in Greg Landweber and Kevin Iga and Charles Doran, we've actually understood even more about these funny images and where they come from. In fact, they have a very strange source, and this is the genetics that I'm talking about possible for reality. Well, I'm going to talk about cubes for a little while. You know what a cube is. Actually, I'm going to talk about not just cubes. I'm going to talk about cubes in all dimensions, right? So you can have a square. That's a kind of a cube on a flat table. If you lift a square up, you produce a cube, the thing that we normally call a cube. If I start with a square, I can populate its vertices with these nodes like I showed you before. Forgetting about all that other mathematics, just think about, I start with these symbols, I start putting little objects at the edges. I colorize each parallel set of edges with the same color. And then I throw in some minus signs. It will take me too long to explain to you why the minus signs are there, but there's a reason why I put them there. It turns out as soon as I have done this, this turns back into the kinds of equations I showed you at the beginning, even if I never knew about those equations. They do so by a process that are like Feynman rules, a trick that physicists learned from the physicist Richard Feynman in describing electromagnetism. Take a real cube, do the same thing. Start with the cube, populate its vertices. Notice that when you populate, you have to do alternate. So it's white dot, black dot. And that pattern has to be true around any face. Colorize. And now this thing at the far right-hand side, I can show you a set of rules that produces equations. These equations have the property of supersymmetry. So there is a very strange relationship between thinking about cubes, which is something that, you know, you would never sort of guess. Cubes have been around, at least in our consciousness, for at least a couple of millennia. So how is it that these cubes have to do with gravity, have to do with electromagnetism? Well, tesseracts, which is what you were watching when we walked in, are cubes in four dimensions. What does that mean? Well, if I take a square and lift it vertically, I form a cube. Suppose I take a cube and lift it in a direction that's not any of the three that we know about. Well, gee, that's hard to do in our world. But mathematically, it's perfectly possible. And if you did that, you form a tesseract. So cubes, if you start with a tesseract, you can populate its vertices like we did before, alternate dark, white. This true works on all possible faces. And then the next step would be to colorize, add in the minus signs, and when you do that, you get this. This object turns out to be related to electromagnetism directly, to Maxwell's equations, the things that we talked about, the waving charges. Maxwell field is actually in the mathematical translation of this object. But now you've noticed that I've started to deform it. I can deform these things because it turns out mathematically I know a lot about algebra and linear algebra and matrices. A lot of techniques we physicists use conventionally in terms of the graphics are nothing but what you're seeing here. It's the deformation. And now, although the initial image I showed you looked pretty complicated, as you can see, with a little bit of work, we can find out there are two identical subcells in the image. That's a very interesting discovery. It wasn't obvious at first. Remember we were talking about beauty and sense of aesthetics before? This is actually prettier, I think, to see the subcell structure. And now finally, having discovered the subcell, I'm going to take the two subcells and smash them together because they're kind of alike. But I'm going to smash them in such a way that black balls go to black balls, white balls go to white balls, solid blue lines go to solid blue lines, dashed reds go to dashed reds, blues go to blues. Everything has to match exactly. And when I do, I get this image. And this image I can open up, and if you look at it very carefully, you'll see it's the thing that I started from with my mathematics. And it turns out these equations describe electron-like objects. And so what we learn is that the equations of Maxwell, which are here shown by the larger figure, and the equations of the electron, which are here shown by the smaller figure, are somehow related to each other by this strange process of taking cubes and smashing them together and asking for preservations so that you don't run into dashes running into solids or blacks running into whites, that you match everything perfectly and one set of equations smoothly deforms to another. This is a way of thinking about equations that's very unusual. In fact, I've never actually seen this before. And so the question is whether I'm crazy enough as to whether this would be useful. But the thing that's really bizarre about this smashing is that it actually has computer codes in it. It turns out when you send messages on your machine, you're typing on your computer, you send messages to someone else, not just the things you type get sent in that message. The computer automatically inserts extra bits in the message. These are called error-correcting codes. And the reason they're put there is because when you transmit the message from one computer to another, there might be an error in transmission. And so there has to be a way for the second computer to detect the errors. And so it turns out that this smashing process that I just showed you, if you look at its mathematics, you can see in it an error-detecting code. Now, this stunned us, my research group and I, when we first discovered that there were error-correcting codes inside the equations of fundamental physics. It turns out that there are lots and lots of ways to smash things together. This is a thing we call climbing Mount Adinkra, where we took 32 colors and asked, how many different ways can you smash them together? And the answers turn out to be maybe 10 to the 12, 10 to the 14, 10 to the 16 different ways. This is in representation theory, what we really are studying here, this is enormous numbers of representations to study string theory and string theory-like cousins with. Let me end by, first of all, following this quote of Albert Einstein, says, after a certain high level of technical skills achieved, science and art coalesce in aesthetics, plasticity, and form. Now, when I set out to become a theoretical physicist many, many years ago, I think I was like most of us. It is our hope that we will find a mathematically magical fact about the universe in which we will. That's, I think, for those of us in theoretical physics, I think that's our highest goal. You want it to be mathematical, you want it to be magical, and you want it to be a fact. That's a really weird triple play to get to work. And yet, that's our goal. And so, the fact that I now find that I'm sort of engaged in artwork, to me, it's a rather astounding place. I didn't plan to be here. So these are some of our simpler Adinkras. Again, I have ways that I can show you how to turn these pictures directly into mathematics in the same way that Feynman graphs turn into mathematics, a very well-known tool to my community. And as you can see, as I start adding numbers of colors and nodes, a weird and beautiful sort of order actually starts to emerge. In fact, when I first saw this order emerging, because we didn't design that to be there either, we didn't design these things to be pretty. We wanted them to be effective as a way of talking about the mathematics. So to see these patterns emerge, for me, was very strange. And in fact, I spent a couple of months just trying to figure out, where is this order coming from? Where are these beautiful patterns coming from? And it comes actually from a very interesting place in the mathematics. It will take me too long in this presentation to talk about, but it has something to do with things that are called matrices. Because the other thing that I didn't tell you about is that Adinkras are also kinds of matrices. And so the order that we see there has to do with choosing what we call a maximally symmetric basis for a set of matrices that underlie these calculations. I should also perhaps say something else about these matrices. They were the type of matrices that enter this are the ones that one that an English mathematician by the name of Clifford invented. It turns out these are Clifford algebras, which is a very special set of objects. It's not surprising in one sense, because Clifford algebras are known to be connected to the electron. This is not what we set out to do. And this story that I'm telling you is sort of representative of how science works. Because you set out to do one thing, and for us it was, we want an effective tool for describing these equations. And so we have been led first to these pictures, which we never knew were there. In fact, the order is actually, we were first led to the matrices, because I was messing with matrices for a very long time. Then we were led to the pictures, in fact, and then finally we were led to the computer codes. And so as you can see, it's kind of like watching a ping pong ball as it bounces around. As you keep pulling a thread, you keep finding more and more intricate connections to interesting mathematics, at least. And so this beauty that emerges, as you increase the number of colors and do the numbers of foldings, gets to be more and more intricate. And so, the next time you hear a mathematician talk about beauty, and you say, what in the world are those people talking about? At least after this lecture, I hope that you can say, well, gee, I actually saw something beautiful emerge from mathematics. Because all I've essentially done here is write a kind of a pictorial storytelling of a set of equations. The equations you're looking at here involve hundreds of variables. But nonetheless, we can at least look at them and appreciate their beauty. I need to acknowledge a number of people. First of all, this work is not my own. Although I sort of dreamed up this program, I work on this with a group of mathematicians, physicists, and computer scientists. These include my collaborators Greg Landweber, Charles Doron, Tristan Hoops, Kevin Ega, Michael Fox, and so we call ourselves the DF Gill Group, where we just take our last initials and string them together, sort of like Bourbaki, if any of you were fans of mathematics. In addition, the work that I've told you about involves a number of animations. Please don't think that I create these animations. I'm nowhere near that talented. And so, in fact, the animations, let me try to pull those up. The animations have been done with the expertise and talent of two incredible young people that I've worked with. I take these crazy ideas of pictures that sort of sit in my head, and I describe them to them, and then they translate them to pictures that you can see. So the people who have actually done that are two. One of them is named Christopher Ferguson, so I have to acknowledge Chris for his skill. In fact, the smashing up diagram that I showed you was me and him working together where I'm getting crazy math out, and he's showing these beautiful images. The Adinkras were drawn by Greg Landweber's software. As I said, we even work with high school students on this, so don't let people tell you that you can be too young to get involved in theoretical physics. We found ways to do that. And I have to also acknowledge the teaching company and Ken Griggs for other of the animations. If any of you have seen the DNA of Reality, you'll find many of the animations of my presentation here actually in that DVD lecture series. And so I have to acknowledge these people because this presentation certainly would not exist in this form without the talents and abilities and dedication of all of my collaborators in this work. So now I'm finally done.
Thank you.
So I think we'd like to take some questions now from the audience. Yep. Could I ask you to come to the microphone? And please speak very close to the microphone so that.
I sort of skimmed through a book by Wolfram called A New Kind of Science. And one of the things that he had in there, in his section on physics, were multidimensional networks, which he generated from very simple algorithms. And I'm just wondering whether I have no idea whether Wolfram's ideas are out to lunch or not, but I'm wondering whether you guys have looked at various possibilities like that.
Sure. Let me just say, first of all, I actually know Stephen. I've known Stephen since around 1980 or so. He's a very brilliant man, obviously, and has accomplished a lot in empowering our community with the invention of Mathematica, which is a main symbolic tool that many, many theoretical physicists use around the world. I'm also aware of his book, A New Kind of Science, so what do I say? Well, before I did this work, I have to tell you quite frankly, I was not paying very much attention to what Stephen was saying, because what Stephen's talking about is moving away from our traditional ways of doing theoretical physics. These are traditional ways, largely, we have inherited from Newton, because the kinds of equations that I showed you folks, namely these equations, these are essentially versions of Newton's second law, but put in the appropriate context to talk about electrons or photons, but it essentially is what Newton told us about calculus. That's what these equations are about. And for a large part of the last several hundred years, that's how we theoretical physicists have basically looked at nature, using the lens of Newton. We now have these powerful devices called computers, and we know how to write, because of them, we are empowered to write algorithms. And so before I actually saw my equations compressed in front in terms of these pictures, I didn't know what to think about what Stephen was proposing. Now, however, having experienced this directly myself, I am much more open to the idea that there is a new kind of science and a new way for theoreticians to think about the fundamental structures in our universe, what I call the genetic structures. I should also mention, since you asked this question, that many, many years ago, a physicist by the name of John Wheeler might have had an inkling about something like this. John invented an aphorism called "it from bit." And the meaning of the aphorism is that it, namely all of our reality, is somehow connected to information, bits. In my calculations here, I directly see how the normal equations of Maxwell, of Einstein, are connected to sets of bits that I see through these pictures. And so in some sense, for the first time, I've actually started to take John Wheeler seriously. I have to tell you, when I was young and first heard these comments, I said, that guy is crazy. However, now I've convinced myself that if you remain a theoretical physicist long enough, you too can become crazy.
Okay, do we have any crazy questions?
I have some questions.
Oh, Jen has some. Yeah.
I have some questions from the online audience, as always. Carol asks, what effect does thought have on the smallest particle and beyond?
I'm sorry, say again.
What effect does thought have on the smallest particle?
What effect does thought have? From the point of view of people like me, we would say it doesn't have an effect because it's the wrong relationship. Thoughts, as far as we can tell, consist of two things. It appears that we ourselves are a type of computer program. And our hardware is mostly up here, it's in our brains, and we're running code. We're a self-aware, self-actualized kind of computer programming. Well, that means that the foundation of thought is electrical current, but the kinds of things that I'm talking about here are before electrical current, so that's why I said it's sort of the wrong way to pose the question, at least in any conventional interpretation a physicist can give you.
I have another one. Tatiana from Toronto asks, if adinkras turn out to be embedded in the nature of reality, what kind of currently unsolved mysteries or paradoxes might they explain?
Well, for me, since this is not a hobby that I've or a lark that I've simply embarked on because I have a lot of time on my hands, there are in my field equations that for 30 years no one has been able to solve. And so our primary purpose of actually establishing these tools was to go after these equations that no one else has figured out how to solve. Among these equations, perhaps, is an improved description of string theory itself.
Thank you.
Could you introduce yourself as well?
Okay, I'm Umar, and I'm a student of mathematical physics and philosophy at the University of Waterloo. I just had a question. You had, at the beginning, the zoom where it zooms in from the atom into the quarks, and then finally into the strings. How far can we zoom in? When do you choose to stop? Because you can keep going on.
No, this is a great question. And in fact, in string theory, there are some indications that there's an end to this zooming in process. There are two ways that we know about this. One of them comes from a very strange thing that's little discussed in string theory called the Gross-Perriwall phase transition. This is David Gross, who won the Nobel Prize for QCD a few years ago, was working with one of his graduate students at Princeton about a decade ago. And what they found by studying the equations of string theory is that when you take this zooming in process to an extreme limit, it looks like space itself may in some sense disappear. We don't really know what's on the other side of the Gross-Perriwall transition, but one of the things that seems to definitely imply is that there's a limit to how much zooming in that you can actually perform before the notion of space itself becomes ridiculous.
Do we have any other questions? Yes, go ahead. Introduce
Hi.
Yourself.
My name is Sue, and I volunteer here at Perimeter. And I didn't think of it until I saw all your pretty pictures, but they kind of reminded me of fractals. Are they at all related to fractals?
As far as, believe me, this was one of the first thoughts I had when I first saw the pretty pictures, is somehow, is there some fractal structure involved here? And the answer seems to be no, for at least from that period of time when I actually concentrated on why these pictures look the way they do. I can't find any evidence of anything like complexity or non-integer Hausdorff number or Lyapunov coefficients. These are technical tools that physicists use to talk about the notion of fractals and incommensurate situations. We see no signs or evidence of these things in this mathematics.
When is the calendar coming out?
The question was, when does the calendar come out? Well, that's a very interesting question because my wife has kind of asked a variation of that question. When I first showed her this work, she was saying she wanted to have a wall hanging woven that looks like these things. So I'm not sure when the answer to that question is going to be. Remember, I'm a physicist, so equations are us, but that's all of us.
So please speak close to the microphone and introduce yourself.
I'm Daniel. I'm a student of engineering physics at Polytechnique in Montreal. I understand that string theory has been filled with lots of math and physics to make it work on paper, and it's got lots of variables that you can adjust to make it agree with experiment. I was wondering, in spite of these setbacks, why do you still believe that string theory is the theory of everything?
Well, I know that in the mind of the general public, there is a debate about whether physicists have put all of our eggs in one basket. But I can tell you, as someone who is a skeptic, because I am skeptical when people tell me things, that as I have looked out at the vista that is called theoretical physics, I don't see anything that is more likely to answer these questions than string theory. And in fact, I do look at other things. About a month or two ago, I wrote a paper where we tried to do some of the intersection between loop quantum gravity and string theory to look for something called the Barbero-Emirsey parameter in the context of supergravity. So it's not that I have simply ruled out other methods for possibly making progress, but I just don't see the optimistic hopes for why anything will be better than string theory. I just don't.
Do you have another question?
I have some more questions from the online audience, if I can step in for a moment here. Rick, the co-host of the PITVO live blog, wants to know, you mentioned the LHC and the protons are traveling at something like 0.99999 the speed of light. What actually does happen if they collide with air particles?
Well, that's actually a pretty simple question to answer. The experiment stops. The point is that, first of all, protons, even though they're traveling at very high speeds, compared to an air molecule, these are like gnats hitting against a bowling ball. So if you have sufficient, unless the vacuum is very well maintained in the pipes, what happens is you just don't get the beam of protons to go around so that you can get your collisions. It just doesn't happen.
Another question from the online audience. Yu Ming asks, as far as I know, many physics theories which have very beautiful and elegant mathematics forms are finally proved to be limited. Just wondering if it is still correct to judge a theory from its form.
No, it's never correct to judge a physics theory from its form. And if that's what your viewer took away from my presentation, then I have failed miserably. What I have said is that it is often the case that our sense of aesthetics is an important guide to finding mathematics, which must later be tested against reality. For us, nature is the ultimate arbiter about what constitutes good physics. And so you can never substitute your sense of beauty for nature's sense of beauty. She is far more clever than you are.
Hi, I'm Jeff Orchard. I'm a computer science faculty member here in Waterloo. Your title uses the word genetic, or the term genetic basis, and it sort of brings up ideas of the theory of evolution. And I've heard the idea batted around that maybe reality as we know it and the physical laws and constants and all those things are sort of an emergent property of some underlying phenomena. Can you comment on that? Is that
well,
where you're
going?
Well,
first of all, yes, I will make some comment. First of all, you should probably direct this question to my host, since he spends more time thinking about this kind of thing than I do. But yes, in fact, the idea of the multiverse, which is one of those expressions we physicists use to describe this, these ideas are receiving pointed investigation right now. And it is possible, and when we look at our equations, Einstein's equations, perhaps a more successful generalization, something along the lines of string theory, what we can see is the possibility that there are, in some sense, many, many, many universes. They're not just our universe. However, in most of these universes, when you look at the equations, they will tell you things like, well, the force of gravity is too weak, and so therefore galaxies don't form, and therefore you don't get planets, and therefore you don't get conscious life. or maybe the constant of electromagnetic repulsion is too strong and atoms don't form properly to get the right chemistry going. So there are lots and lots of ways in which our universe is a miracle. And so when we look at the vast panoply of equations and say, well, how did we wind up to be so fortunate as to be in a universe where everything is Goldilocks-like, right? It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right. And so this is part of what's called anthropic reasoning, but the way that I think most of us interpret this is that, in fact, we are indeed lucky that most of these other universes may well exist. They're not accessible to us directly. In fact, their influences we'll see perhaps by looking at the cosmic microwave background or the distribution of dark energy or some very, very ephemeral effect in our reality. Maybe they're there, and a lot of people are debating it. Like I said, you talk to Neil, I'm sure he'll talk to you about it. But do we know that it's true? Well, probably the best way to say it is we need to keep an open mind in looking at such questions. And I think the community is actively doing so.
Hello, I'm Somit Gupta from University of Waterloo. I want to ask, we have these universal constants, which are like the gravitational constant or Planck's constant. So is there any evidence that they are really a constant or they can change over a period of time, which would be very large?
Sure.
And one more thing I would like to ask is, we could talk about reality, but are we really sure we do live in a real world? Like, Can it be that we are just in a simulation, which is really good, and somebody's just
sure.
playing?
Let me make some comments about your second question first. No, I don't think we can be sure. In fact, my own work in finding these codes embedded in fundamental physics has been one of the most shocking things in my professional career. I never set out to find computer codes buried in the equations of fundamental physics. So, can we be sure that reality is not just a simulation? No, I don't think we can be sure. On the other hand, unless you can propose a scientific test for that, the question itself is not a scientific question. It's a philosophical question. For people who have that bent, I would say if you think that's true, then you need to push that to produce science, not just to raise a question that would be a wonderful way to spend an afternoon sailing down a river talking to your best friends about. The changing of the constants, well, let me talk about the constant that again, and I will defer to Neil because he works in this area. The constant that I think most of us find the most interesting in changing its value is something called the cosmological constant. Because apparently we live in a universe where the cosmological constant has made at least three changes. Right after the Big Bang, it assumed a value which caused inflation to come about. That's one of the explanations about what it does. And then it went quiescent. It essentially went to a vanishing value, and the universe expands at a constant rate for 5, 6, 7 billion years. About 4 billion years ago, it looks like the cosmological constant changed its size again, and now we live in an era in which the universe is speeding up its expansion. So, yeah, there's some evidence at least that particular constant changes, and if that one does, then you have to ask about all of them.
Thank you.
Okay, I think if there are no more questions, let me thank Jim again.
Let me say that I always give my audience a round of applause for sitting there and listening.
You don't need to, Jim. You really don't need to. So that's all we have time for now. Let me just give you a few reminders. The next event is called The Best Way to Predict the Future is to Invent It Yourself. That will be with Peter Diamandis. That'll be at 1 p.m. EDT. Don't forget to check out all the other events by going to qtcfestival.com. Thank you very much to those of you who've come here to Perimeter Institute to watch this wonderful lecture, and thank you to those who are watching online. The presentation will continue to be available online, so please share the website link with others who may be interested. Let me also mention the chapter's bookstore is open at the back of the atrium with a selection of books chosen to suit these themes. And as our next session starts very soon, I wonder if I can ask you all to leave the theater as quickly as you can. Thank you very much.